All right. Hey, everybody. This is the Mac. This is the No Chaser Show with Mac Williams. I am here today on a Friday night, as I am, at 8 o'clock. The show is sponsored by Trinity Web Solutions, trinitywebsolutions.org. You can get email, web, do-it-yourself websites. Everything is offered there. So when you get a chance, if you have a business, if you have any ideas or anything, you can go over to trinitywebsolutions.org. That is trinitywebsolutions.org. Tonight, I have a special guest. He was supposed to be here last week, but he got busy, and he's here today. And his name is Scott Hirsch. He is the CEO and founder of AppsBar, one of the places I found on the Internet one day by mistake and looked him up, found him on Facebook, became friends with him, and I have him here on the show, so I want to introduce everybody to Scott Hirsch, CEO of AppsBar. Hey, Scott, how you doing?
I'm doing great. It's great to be on the show.
Good. Thank you. Thank you for coming, man. Thank you for spending the hour with us, man. I really appreciate that. Scott, tell us a little bit about what I really want to delve into first is what is your, you know, tell us a little bit about your background as far as like, you know, where'd you start as far as in business or wherever you started from. Tell us a little bit about where you started from.
Going back a ways to the mid-80s, I was one of the people that helped to start a company called Lens Express. And it was a novel idea of getting contact lenses directly to the consumers, much like a pharmacist sells you your refills for your prescriptions. Mm-hmm. You don't need to get it from the doctor
right.
at an inflated price.
Right.
The same with the contact lenses.
Mm-hmm.
And as much as that sounds pretty normal today, with our company ended up becoming 1-800-CONTACTS, that's what they're known as today, but it was unheard of at that time. And in 1991, I was turned on to something called the bulletin board systems, which was the earliest form of online advertising.
Hmm.
And I was really a direct marketer. That's what I consider myself. And what drew me to it was not that I'm especially technical or that I saw something brilliant about it. It was that it was free to advertise. And, you know, no matter how big your budget is, everyone has a limited advertising budget. And I said, wait
Absolutely.
A minute, there's no cost to, you know, to try to sell the contacts on here. So in 91, I started with this bulletin board systems, and then later with Galacticom and O'Reilly Web, which are some very early web stuff, and then later Prodigy and CompuServe. We had one of the first, you know, worldwide web sites actually selling merchandise, selling the contact lenses, and went up to Virginia and built a store for the first ever AOL mall in the early 90s, too, for Lens Express. And about the mid-90s, I said to myself, as successful as we were selling contact lenses, that there's a whole lot more opportunity on this Internet, on the World Wide Web at the time, you know, selling other things besides contact lenses. And eventually that's what I started doing. And by the mid-90s, I started the first ever opt-in email company where folks would give you their email address in exchange for information in certain areas. And what I did is the first site I did was called winningkey.com, and we gave away a Porsche every year. And your email address might be the winning key that opens that Porsche up. And it was a novel idea at the time, so a lot of people signed up, and it was a very successful company. We sold it later to the credit giant Equifax.
Wow.
And that would, you know, and I've been in and around online marketing ever since, so from 91 on. And that's what led eventually. I did an early social network, which I sold to Lehman Brothers. I had done promotion for some of the real early web stuff from Yahoo to Napster to MySpace. I'd done a lot of the email and promotion for them. And AppsBar is where I ended up because I saw a new frontier off of the web and onto the mobile devices as the next generation.
Right. And that's interesting because it's funny, like, I try to use the show, when I'm on the show, I try to use the show to encourage people that to use their talents and their ideas and things and monetize them and learn how to monetize them, learn how to pay your bills with them. I'm a big believer in taking your talents and whatever your God-given talent is and making it pay you. Because if you work for yourself and you're doing something that you love to do, the money follows. I really find that. And it's funny how you went from one thing to the other thing to the other thing. But, Scott, let me ask you this. In this process of all the things you started doing, how did you handle adversity, or how did you handle, you know, things that fail? Because obviously, you know, on this road to AppSpar, I know you failed probably a lot in certain areas. How did you just keep coming back, and how did you just keep going?
I look at it like this. You only fail if you quit. I just looked at every challenge as a learning experience.
Right.
I've made a million mistakes, but mm-hmm. I hope to think that I've learned from most of them so I wouldn't at least mm-hmm. make the same one, you know, consecutively.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly.
And
okay.
That's how I look at it, that you only fail if you quit.
Right.
You know, because you...
Well, I'm glad.
Huh?
And
you know,
can you hear me? Oh, okay.
Yes, I can. You know, I think that's one of the biggest. Yeah, I think it's one of the biggest problems people have, is mm-hmm. they quit or they stop before they're able to have that success they're seeking. It might have been around the
right.
corner. It might have been another month, another year, whatever the case is.
But they quit
know?
Beforehand. Right. They just quit
yes.
beforehand. I get it. And that's what I tell people all the time. I think one of the things that I know in the Black community, I know in my community, nowadays I think people just quit as soon as there's some obstacle or as soon as something goes wrong, they think that's, well, it's stopped. And I just quit and I go to something else and we never stick with it until we do have success. So I appreciate you saying that. Now when you got into AppSpar, what made you get into that, and how did you start with AppSpar?
Well,
with that?
I started a new internet marketing company in 2008, and mm-hmm. I was doing pretty much the same thing I'd done previously. And what I started to see was that, much like in the mid-90s, everybody wanted a website, whether they even knew why they wanted one.
Right.
Everybody wanted an app in 2008, 2009. The
right.
problem was they just weren't affordable. The average person, these people wanted, for a decent app, $25,000 and $50,000.
Exactly.
And
absolutely.
To a small business or a medium business, that's cost prohibitive. They can't afford
right.
that. You know,
right.
that would literally, you know, that might be their entire advertising budget, or it might be more than they make in a quarter or a year or whatever the case is. So I said, this just doesn't
right.
make sense, because you have this huge phenomenon of applications running on smartphones, a million smartphones being sold a day,
mm.
but yet the majority of people and the majority of businesses are being excluded. And only the super technical and the largest businesses are getting on board. And it didn't strike me as a good policy,
mm-hmm.
and it certainly didn't strike me as fair. And it shocked me that the large companies that are running these app markets were so happy to keep it this way. And I said, if I can figure out how to get people an application – either free or at a reasonable cost,
right?
And help to democratize this app world, giving an opportunity to those who are now kept out because of, you know, they don't have the prerequisite technical skill, which is a lot of skill, or they don't have
mm-hmm.
thousands and thousands of dollars, that we could open up a whole new app market per se. And I didn't know how you'd make money doing that at the moment, but I knew you could, because it was just an opportunity to address a real problem in a marketplace.
Right. So let me ask you this. So with having said all that, when you started, what is your usership now? I mean, how successful is AppsBar now? I mean, I don't, you know, even though I see it on the web and I see it there and I'm like, I'm really with it. Like, when I saw it, I was just like, wow, this is incredible. Like, you can actually do this, you know, stuff like that. And I went on YouTube and looked at a few videos of some people instructing how to use it and things like that. How many users since you have started? Because when did AppsBar start?
Okay.
We started
in 2011, in April of 2011. With no users, obviously, we had to start with the first one. And today we have 1,200,000 people that have tried AppsBar. They're either built an app with AppsBar or in the process of building an app with AppsBar.
Wow.
And we're really proud of that. And we get up to 80,000 people a day coming to the site, you know.
Wow.
So it's really grown.
And what is your – let me ask you this. What are the limitations to the app? Are there any obvious limitations, like things that you can't do with the app, or is it strictly? Are you guys going to improve it to where it can do more with the apps, or what is the plan moving forward with AppsBar?
That's a good question, and I'll explain what AppsBar can and can't do very simply without, you know, boring anyone with tons of features that do and don't exist. Which is like this. Mm-hmm. If you want to build an app that's going to be your business, AppsBar is not the right platform for you. But if you need an app for your business, whatever that might be, you know, we have local restaurants, we have dry cleaners, we have charities.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We have virtually any kind of business you could think of. We have, you know, galleries selling furniture and art and things like this. If you need an app for your business, AppsBar can accommodate virtually any business out there. And it's free.
Okay.
If you need to build an app that's going to be your business, you're going to need a lot of customization because your business has to be different, you know, your app, or else what's the point in doing it?
Exactly.
Yes, you can build some video games with AppsBar, but it's not, you're not going to build the next Angry Birds. I'm not, you know, not likely. You know, and
but
you can have you can build a very good quality app with AppsBar. There's a lot of features, but it isn't. I'm not going to say it's a panacea that, you know, everyone gets on and builds an app and gets rich. No, much like you need a website for your business at this point, with millions and millions of people carrying smartphones everywhere they go, you need an app for your business, and that's where AppsBar fits in.
Okay, good. Well, let me ask you this. Well, what is your next plan? Is there any plans for AppsBar? Like, is there any features or anything that you're going to add to it, or is it basically just going to be where it is right now, or do you have any plans for it or anything in the future?
There will be a new AppsBar in the next 3 months. Sorry to cut in. I should slow
down
a little
problem,
bit. In the
no
next
problem.
3 months,
no problem.
There will be a full new AppsBar, and what we've done is we have added some features, and one of the biggest things is what we tried to do is make it more intuitive and easier to use and cut down on the steps it takes you to use.
Okay.
And we've added a lot of the features around design and making the apps look better and easier to build. But there will be some new features. I don't want to talk about too much yet because we're going to be releasing about 3 months from now. But
we're
very excited. And AppsBar is never done. That's my philosophy, is that when we do it 3 months from now, we should very shortly start thinking about what the next version is.
Oh, I get it. And I understand that. And rest assured, Scott, when you have the new, I will be checking with you, because when you get the new one, we're going to have you back on. You know, because
you.
This thing, I mean, to me, I just went through a friend of mine who was trying to get and design an app. And I saw all the struggle they went through with, you know, trying to get it done, money. And then if you take shortcuts, you get the guy who can develop it, or you got somebody who got some knowledge on it, but then you always run it. You get what you pay for, I find. You know, when you get somebody who can do it for low cost and, you know, you're not paying them as much, you know, you're paying them a little bit, you tend to get that much in effort or whatever else. And I find that that's not a good thing. So, I mean, what I think you have here, I don't think a lot of people know about. I mean, I stumbled onto it on the internet one day. I can't remember how I did it, but I ended up on AppSpot. No, I know what it was. I ended up on your page by mistake. I don't know how I did it, but I saw AppSpot on the top. I think you know what it was. I think because me and you both are boxing people. We really love boxing. You're actually in it. I'm just a fan. And I think one day I saw your name on something, and I tend sometimes when I look at a post, I tend to check the people out who are on the post. And
sure,
just say, oh,
of course,
what
I do the
do.
Same
or,
thing.
Oh, they wonder what they do. Yeah, because I'm always trying to add to, you know, if it's a good person, it's friends and things like that. I try to add on, try to find out. And so I saw it, and when I saw AppSpot on your top of your page, I was like, I wonder what that is. So I went to it, and that's how I found it. And then I was like, wow. And I was like, oh, this is, you know, and then I read up on your page, whatever, and I was like, you know what? I'm going to send this guy, a friend request. And then I always saw you on anything boxing, you know, your pictures, everything. I just saw it, and I was like, this guy must be somehow, he must be I kept thinking it was different. I kept thinking, oh, he's a rich guy who has the money enough to go to these events and go to boxing and actually see the stuff in person and this and that. And I saw, and I was like, oh, that's really cool. So it was kind of funny. So then now getting to know you, I'm like, oh, okay, I see it's a little bit deeper. And when I read up on you and I did my research, I found out that you actually were a manager, a boxing manager. How did you come up with that, Scott? That's what I want to know. How did you come up how did you get into that business?
Well, that started much earlier. When I was a little kid, mm-hmm. I grew up here in South Florida, and my grandfather mm-hmm. used to take me to what they called the Fifth Street Gym in those days. And lucky enough, Miami Beach had, at that time, the top gym in the world, and Angelo Dundee was the head trainer. My grandfather was friendly with his brother, Chris. So we would go and watch, and among the people that we would watch was Muhammad Ali. Jimmy mm-hmm. Ellis was also a heavyweight champion and Ali's top sparring partner, and many, mm-hmm. many other top fighters. So I mm-hmm. got a love for boxing at a very early age, and I mm-hmm. went to several fights, and I watched literally every fight on TV, and I just became a big boxing fan. My first live fight, George Foreman fought on the card. Roberto Duran defended a title. It was Michael Doak's pro debut. Yeah, it was the Hollywood Sportatorium. I still remember that. And I remember watching the Rumble in the Jungle, the Thrill in Manila as a little kid and just being, you know, it was
Me
a
too.
Great time in boxing. Muhammad Ali was, you know, bigger than life. And
exactly.
getting to see him live and speak to him and speak to his lovely wife at the time, you know, Belinda, who would be there, and Jimmy Ellis, who recently passed, who would be there, you know, and his brother Rockman. They were all very friendly people. So it mm-hmm. was just a wonderful thing. And I always wanted to be in the boxing business. I didn't mm-hmm. know exactly how. And I remember being maybe 8 or 10 years old at school, and they mm-hmm. asked everybody, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up? And this person said a nurse and a doctor and a fireman and a police officer. And I said, I want to be a boxing promoter like Don King. I think everybody.
I'm pretty sure
funny.
You got a bunch of laughs in there.
Yeah, half of them didn't know what I meant. And I just have always been in that direction. And I got involved with some local fighters here.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
you know, unofficially was helping them. And the first well-known or somewhat well-known boxing person, a fighter who I actually managed, was a really interesting guy. And it was Mitch Blood Green. And
I know Mitch Green. Is Mitch Green, that's the Mitch Green that got punched in the eye by Mike Tyson?
Yes, in the ring and in the street they fought. And so that was my first fighter, and we had an interesting relationship. And
oh, my God.
I worked with some local fighters here in South Florida, Robert Daniels, who was a cruiserweight champion, and a guy named Melton Bowen, who was a heavyweight contender. And then
mm-hmm.
Later, I ended up working with Shannon Briggs.
Yeah,
and we had a wonderful run in 2005 and 2006. and 2007, and, you know, all the way to the WBO World Heavyweight title, and that was really something special. And, you know, I still have a couple of title belts here at the house, thanks to that one from the WBO and one from Ring Magazine, both thanks to Shannon Briggs, and that was a wonderful opportunity in the sport.
Okay. And you're not involved in the sport anymore now, so you just pretty much
well,
go to Vegas and go to fights and things like that?
Yeah, I have a young fighter that I work with a little bit, you know, try to not in a professional level because he's just literally a young kid. He just turned – or he's turning 15 next month in November. He's only 14 now, mm-hmm. and he's the current world champion in his age in the 119-pound class. And his name's Dominique Francis, and he's a heck of a fighter. And mm-hmm. I'll also work with some other young fighters here and there. The mm-hmm. last professional fighter that I worked with was Corey Spinks.
Okay.
And since Corey retired, you know, he was a five-time world champion. I haven't worked with another fighter. Doesn't mean I wouldn't, you mm-hmm. know. I just haven't.
Okay.
And I was offered a couple fighters right at the end of Corey's career. I'm one of these people that just, if I work with a fighter, I take it very personally. I think mm-hmm. I take the losses even harder than the fighter does, unlike a lot of managers who, or promoters
yep.
who just, you know, it's irrelevant.
They don't
just grab the next guy. And
right.
It was tough because he's such a talented guy and we've become so close. So it was tough at the end there. And I'm still close with all the fighters I've been involved with. So I passed on a couple of very good fighters, probably mistakes to pass on them at different times, because, you know, and
mm-hmm.
Including one not that long ago. But if the right opportunity came, who knows?
So you're still open for business, but you're just. Would it be safe to say you're just a little picky of who you want to work with?
Yeah, I think it would just be, you know, you just have to find. It's almost like, you know, getting in a relationship. You just
well,
got
to
mesh.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
You know?
You want to be careful with who you're getting involved with. You don't just want to.
Absolutely.
And
not even that. I'm judging the people. Just that they would work
right.
well with me, and that I would work well with them. And,
right,
and
that makes sense. That makes sense.
Yeah, young Dominique, I think just 3 or 4 years from now, which, you know, goes so quickly, is going to really impress people. I remember some years back at a gym for a number of years down here with a number
mm-hmm.
of professional fighters training there, and a
mm-hmm.
young amateur came in who was getting ready for the Olympic trials. And
mm-hmm.
that named Terrence Crawford from Nebraska.
Yeah,
I watched this kid
Crawford.
And I said, wow, he's about 17. Wow, he really has something. He was working with Anthony Wilson, Chill, they call him, getting ready for the
mm-hmm.
Olympic trials. And in Dominique Francis, the young boy is just going to turn 15. I see the same kind of talent and the same level that Crawford had at 17.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just
right.
how impressed I am with him.
Yeah, because Terrence Crawford is becoming a superstar.
Yeah, absolutely. And you could see he had that ability then, you know. And
mm-hmm.
you never know. I had a guy a couple years back, right when everything was winding down with Corey a few years back, tell me, you know, I got
mm-hmm.
this guy for you. I had managed his brother, and he had worked as a trainer for me, and he said, you know, named Nicholas Walters from Jamaica. I never heard of him, you know. We just went through a couple of losses. I don't want to get involved with some unknown guy. And I never even checked it out. You know,
right.
I just, even as well as I knew him, I just wasn't in the right place. You know, it was like someone had just lost a friend, you know, because
right.
like, it was,
exactly,
I just felt
exactly,
so bad about
exactly.
it. And it turns out he would have been a real good fighter to work with. I've heard nothing
exactly.
but good things about him, of course. So,
no, and I get it. And that
has taught me to be a little more open-minded if someone brings
exactly.
me something.
Exactly. Now, when you make your decision about these fighters, is it more about the ability or is it a mixture of the ability and the personality, who the person is or what have you? Is that
well,
how you got to make your decision?
Well, I got to start with the ability because I learned that early on that
mm-hmm.
this sport, unlike a lot of other sports, you know, you could be an agent, let's say, for an NBA player. That's the 7th, 8th, or 10th guy on the team, and you could still do well. In boxing, if
mm-hmm.
you can't be a world champion
mm-hmm.
or a near world champion, if you don't have that ability, it's never going to make sense as a business. So you've got to start with that the fighter has at least the ability to be a world champion. I didn't realize that early on, but I've learned that. And then from there, yeah, you've got to see if, as a person, if you really care about the job of managing a fighter, it becomes a very close relationship. So you just got to see that you gel and that you both have the same vision of what a path is going to look like. And,
right.
I think that's one of the reasons Shannon and I were successful. Jamil McClain and I got the 3 world title shots, though I would like to have gotten the title. We came inches away, is because we had the same vision, and that's what I would look for in a fighter. Somebody, you know.
Right. Right. So, let me ask you, with all that you've done in boxing. Has what you did with Shannon Briggs been more satisfying than anything else?
Certainly that night when we won, you know, the title in it was November 4th of 2006 in Phoenix at the stadium. There was the culmination for me, but I think every win just felt great. You know, just you know, when you work with a fighter and you get
absolutely
to the fight and. And I've never been in the position where I started with a fighter that was highly regarded, highly rated, given an HBO or Showtime contract. I've never been in that position. I've always started with guys that either were coming from nowhere or had been up but were now down. So, it's truly like a Rocky story in that when you see somebody come, you know, from where nobody wants to talk to them to fighting for a championship, you know, fighting on national television, it's very satisfying. So all of them were good.
Okay.
I just took the losses pretty hard.
I get it. You have a passion for it.
Exactly.
Scott, let me ask you this. Let's talk a little bit about one of my all-time favorite fighters, Floyd Mayweather. That's just, I mean, a guy from Grand Rapids. I'm a kid who was born and raised in Detroit, Michigan. So I know Grand Rapids. I know where it is. I know, you know, how bad it can be, whatever, that area. So for me, the thing that impresses me about Floyd Mayweather is that he is, he really does the sweet science. It's pure boxing, and I'm a boxing purist. I like to see it in its purest form. Don't get me wrong. I like a rumble. I like to see people, you know, I like to see guys throwing punches and bunches and get hit. But I'm such a fan of the sweet science. And when I saw Floyd first when he started, I just thought, you know, the hand speed, the foot movement, the hit and not get hit. I've been in love with that from day one. I've always loved it when Muhammad Ali, because Muhammad Ali was the first person, you know, I actually saw a dude the hit and not get hit. And I'm talking about the black and white fights. I ain't talking about the color fights when he was getting his head knocked off, you know, when he was taking tough fights. But I always loved it. And to watch his career go and to watch how successful he's been, you know, there's a lot of people who don't like him, a lot of people who hate him. And, you know, for me, I just think it's because, I mean, flat out, I think Floyd came in, got a plan together and executed it. But I think the biggest thing why people hate Floyd, I think is because everybody was waiting for him to get his comeuppance, and he never got it. He flashed, he bragged, he did everything he did, and he made a lot of money with it, and he left out unscathed, never with a loss. And I think people who don't like Floyd really hated that, because I think they wanted to see him, quote, in their minds, quote, unquote, get humbled. And it just never happened. And I think that's why they're still talking about him now, even though he's been gone. I don't think he's coming back. At least I hope he doesn't. You know, I just wanted to know your thoughts on Floyd Mayweather. I've met Floyd Mayweather before, and I've gotten to watch him work out for a 3-hour workout at his gym. And like you said, you saw Muhammad Ali and those people do it. It was the same experience for me. When I saw it, it was just like, man, this dude kills himself. Like, this dude's not just talking. He's actually putting in the work behind it. And to see that was just amazing. So I just want to know your thoughts on Floyd Mayweather and what you think.
Well, I would start with, in my opinion, Floyd is the best defensive fighter ever. Floyd is also in-ring in terms of ring generalship, making adjustments to other fighters' styles during the fight, mid-fight adjustment, the best I've ever seen. And then you just hit on something, and you can talk about all the greats of the past from Sugar Ray Robinson and Armstrong and Ali, and they were all truly great. But Floyd is the best-conditioned fighter ever.
Yeah,
and you couldn't have been as well-conditioned because you didn't have access to all of the wonderful things you do today, you know? You couldn't train as much as Floyd trained because you didn't have all these other ways to recoup. You didn't have, you know, everything he has. And he's one of the hardest workers there's been, and people don't see that blue-collar side to him, which is a guy from Grand Rapids, Michigan, that's outworking all his opponents. They see a guy making it look easy in the ring, and it kind of looks easy because it's been so hard in the preparation. The hard work is done, you know, at the gym, which you may see or most folks wouldn't see. And Floyd is not a true knockout artist, though he's certainly capable of knocking anybody out. People don't appreciate that he's done what he's done, and it's, you know, tremendous with bad hands. And boxers having bad hands is like the equivalent of a running back having a bad knee. It's almost unfathomable to think that here he is, maybe the greatest ever and certainly the greatest of this generation and the most successful financially by far. And, you know, I believe he fought 21 world champions, and he's got two bad hands, you know, that are constantly giving him trouble. So I just think he's a one-of-a-kind fighter. And remember, Ali was not beloved like he is today during his heyday.
Absolutely.
Many people watch those fights hoping to see Ali lose.
And you know what's funny?
And the same thing is with Floyd. And I think the next generation will have an appreciation for Floyd Mayweather when they look back.
Oh, of course. And the thing about it is the main beef that I've always had with a lot of my friends on Facebook is that, you know, there's a lot of criticism of Floyd. You know, they'll be like, you know, Floyd talked too much. He talked too much trashness. And I keep telling them, I said, dude, Muhammad Ali was like, I mean, Floyd is a little bit worse than Floyd. I said, but y'all don't understand. Man, Muhammad Ali was showing up at people's training camps talking trash. I mean, I'm talking about, you know, a black gorilla, calling a black man in the 70s a gorilla was controversial. You know, I said, man, Muhammad Ali was talking more trash, just as much trash as Floyd was. I said, but y'all don't criticize him. You think it's okay. It was cool. I said, but it wasn't back then. And I said the same thing you did is that, you know, Muhammad Ali was a great fighter, but he talked trash just like Floyd. He was flashy. He bragged on himself. He did the same things that Floyd does outside the ring as far as the braggadocious, the promote. But, I mean, they promote a fight. I mean, that's what they do. But some of that is who they really are. And, you know, what I find is it hypocritical that they're so badly beat on him about that. And I'm like, but Muhammad Ali was the same. You know, and I present this, and I said this to a lot of people, and a lot of people don't like it. But I told him, I said, let's be honest. I said, Floyd is a better boxer, pure boxer, than Muhammad Ali was, in my opinion. I said, but here's the thing that gets me. I said, you guys don't appreciate Floyd. I said, but let's keep it straight. And this is just me being honest, Scott. But I said, Muhammad Ali is beloved so much by the black community because of what he did outside the ring. Inside the ring, he wasn't as well respected as he was. They liked him. Trust me, liked having a black heavyweight champion. I said, but what he did outside the ring, the throwing away of the gold medal, the not going to Vietnam, the 3 years or whatever he lost from his career, I said, what he stood for, being with Malcolm X and being a Muslim, I said, those are why he's so beloved now, more than he was his boxing. I said, so to sit here and act like, well, you know, Muhammad Ali was this great figure in his ground. I said, yeah, he did a lot. Don't get me wrong. You can't compare the outside the ring stuff with Floyd. It's not comparable. Even though I know for a fact Floyd feeds the homeless, he does a lot of things that he doesn't get in front of the camera and say, look what I did. But the thing that bothers me, though, is that I tell him all the time, Muhammad Ali back in his day, what he did outside the ring, losing his career for those 3 years and the stuff that he stood for is the biggest thing, I think, why people beloved him, more than what was in the ring. you know, more so. I'm not that they weren't proud of it. I was proud of him as being a black heavyweight champion. But what he did outside the ring is more what I think he's appreciated for than the boxing. And it's almost sacrilege to say that, you know, Floyd is a better boxer than Muhammad Ali. But I mean, they have different views. And, you know, I personally agree with you as far as financially. I don't think nobody will make more money than Floyd will ever make in boxing. I don't see it. I don't see that. That guy left, you know, damn near a billionaire, if he isn't. And I'm just like, really? You know, and I just don't think nobody can touch it. And the funny thing is, I don't see a lot of fighters following the same blueprint. And that's what I don't see, and I'm surprised, because I would think that they would follow that blueprint, you know, of starting your own promotion, which some of them are, and just doing it the way Floyd did it. But I don't know. You know, you're more inside than I am. And, you know, I agree with you 110% about Floyd and your feelings about Floyd. And he's really a nice guy. When I met him, he was a very open, down-to-earth guy. I mean, you would never think that he was, you know, who he is, because I got to see him when, you know, we were at the gym. Wasn't that many people in there at that time. I remember meeting him, and then like a half hour later, Joe Jackson walks in. And I was just like, this day couldn't get any better than this. This is crazy. And he's a really nice guy, too, very down to earth. You know, I just, like I said, you being in the boxing business, you know, to hear you say that makes me feel like, okay, I was right about what I said. But, you know, there's a lot of people out there that really don't like Floyd, that just, you know, hate what he did. And I think he did a lot of good for boxing, a lot of good for boxing. I think guys are making more money now because of him. And especially the drug testing, I think, is a good thing, too, which nobody gives him very much credit with, but I give him a lot of credit for doing it. But let me ask you this question, Scott. What do you think about Al Haymon? Do you know Al Haymon? And can you tell me a little bit about what he's brought to the table? Because to a man, I've heard all boxers, they love him. Other promoters hate him. But to a man, I've heard some of the biggest names in boxing who are men just say, he's a great guy, da 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 da. But I didn't know if you wanted to shed any light on that or knew anything about Al Haymon.
Sure. I mean, to say I know Al Haymon would be a little bit of an exaggeration. You know, I know
of
Al. I know a lot about Al. I've been in the same, you know, business as him. And I know a lot of those who are very close to him, you know, Am Watson and Louis DeCubas Jr. And a lot of these guys who are like his lieutenants, have a much closer relationship with. But what I do know about Al is he also, much like me, has a tremendous loyalty to the fighters he's worked with. And many fighters find that the day that their fighting career is over, those relationships end and there's nowhere to go. And Al, I know of, you know, and I don't want to embarrass, you know, some former fighters who were great champions and, you know, and I have a lot of respect for. But I know of three different fighters who started with Al and have run into different types of problems, you know, and Al has gone way above and beyond. Not during their career, not when they had any, you know, value now, you know, but later, you know, in life, when he was doing it from the heart. And secondly, I think that he's done a great job of maximizing the value of all these fighters. I can never figure out in Floyd's incredible superstardom, is it 80% Floyd and 20% Al, or 80% Al and 20%, or 50-50? And I think only those with the most intimate knowledge would know.
Exactly.
But obviously, the two of them have done a great job together. And if you look at Al's earliest fighters, Vernon Forrest and Antonio Tarver and some of these other guys that, you know, had some great success and he's had great loyalty too, and guys like an Andre Berto who have fallen on losses and have seemed to be able to become recycled, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
He doesn't give up on a guy when he loses one. So I have a lot of respect for him, and I have a lot of respect for what he's done in the sport. I think that he's tried a new paradigm. And any time you break a business model that benefits a lot of people, and you break out of it, that's going to be threatening to those people, and I think that's what's caused a lot of the negativity, is nobody wants to lose money. Our last week was with Don King, who's a dear friend and, you know, probably the most successful boxing promoter ever, if you look at, you know, career, from the Rumble in the Jungle, the Thrill in Manila, to all the Tyson fights, and Trinidad, and Chavez, and on and on and on. And he has nothing but the highest regard for Al and what he's doing. And really, you know, sees him, I guess, as the next generation.
Wow. And
yeah, we were talking about this just last week.
Wow. I mean, the biggest thing I know, Scott, is, you know, the fighters love him. And so, to me, you know, I'm on the outside, but when I kept seeing everybody saying Al Haymon is this, Al Haymon is great, blah, 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 and I'm sitting here going like, man, you know, all these fighters are, you know, praising this guy. And then, you know, with the new, what's to call it, the new boxing
PBC?
Show thing that he started. The PBC.
Yeah, the Premier Boxing Show.
And all these things. And everybody loves it. You know, the boxers all to a man, just like, I love this. I love the platform. We're getting to be seen by other people, and it's, you know, and it's great. And it seems to me that the boxers must be making a lot of money, a lot more money than they were with Al Haymon. And I knew when I heard what they were saying, and then I heard Oscar De La Hoya, what's the other guy's name? The other guy.
Bob Arum.
Bob Arum, you know, with this ranting and raving, and he's bad for business, and I figured it out. You know, that's when I started to figure it out. I said, okay, somebody here must be losing money, you know, because, to be honest, you never saw back in when we were growing up, you didn't see boxers. Boxers were rich, but you didn't see boxers retiring like, I'm rich and I'm cool and I'm good. And you don't hear about them no more, and then next thing you know, you hear them on Hard Times, this, that. So somewhere along the line, the promoters are making all the money and the boxers weren't. Now it's kind of flipped.
And not only was it the money, but the other thing that Al has put in the hands of the Floyd Mayweathers and some of these top fighters is control. As great as Ali was, and, you know, and like you said, if you look at what he did outside the ring and inside the ring together, you could say he's one of the greatest people of his generation. Forget about just great fighters, you know?
Absolutely.
But as great as he was, he never truly controlled his own career.
No,
it was controlled by promoters. It was controlled by his management, Herbert Muhammad, and he didn't call his own shots. He fought and to his credit, he fought anyone, anytime, anywhere. But he fought basically, you know, who they had for him, and he did it under those terms. He didn't dictate where he was going to fight. He wasn't in that type of position. And
he just
now
has
empowered Floyd to call all the shots, and I think that's caused a lot of the resentment. And I think that, you know, they bought their way out of the top rank contract, which was, you know, unusual.
Smart.
Nobody pays the promoter.
Now.
It looks very smart in hindsight, but, it was risking whatever was close to $1 million, you know.
Exactly.
And then
exactly.
On top of that, agreed to an 80-20 split, taking only 20% of the pay-per-view to fight De La Hoya, knowing that winning that fight would put him at another stratosphere, you know, and that they would go from there. And that's what they did. And they, you know, so they took some chances and they took the short end of the stick a few times. And then ultimately they were in a position to dictate. They had become, as people say in boxing, the proverbial A-side, and he dictated everything. And I think that's what upsets some people, because they're not ready to accept that a boxer, a young, brash guy, you know, is going to be not only the best fighter, but making all the decisions.
Yeah.
And if you want to fight him, you're going to do it on his terms.
Exactly. And to me, and just me and you talking here, to me, you know, I think there are, I think the sport, I think personally, boxers should have that right. Because I'm sorry, that's one of the few sports where you get your head knocked off. I mean, you get your head beat, your body beat to a pulp. You know, I think it's a travesty that football doesn't get guaranteed contracts. You know, like basketball players. I said, it's amazing. The sports that are the, I said, the sports that are given all the guarantees are the sports that are the least amount of chances that, you know, you're going to get into, get hurt and get into an accident. I said, football is the most, is probably, I would equate to boxing. The only difference is they have a little bit of padding on to protect themselves. But those are the two main sports that it's like, man, how does that work? You know, you get your body beat, your head beat, your brain rattled, and you're not supposed to have any control. Like, you're not supposed to call, like, who you want to fight, when you want to fight, where you can, or what. I mean, to me, that's what I love about Al Haymon, is that you're right. He did give him, he's giving them control. You know, I've heard boxers say they're making more money with Al Haymon. Like, I never thought I could make this much money, and And I'm like, that's great. And I'm, you know, and so hearing you say that confirms that. And, you know, I you know, for me, for my taste, I've never liked Bob Arum that much anyway. I think he's a lying sack of doo doo. But I mean, I don't, you know, the whole Pacquiao thing was ridiculous. I, you know, I lost respect for Pacquiao after he did that. You know, the whole, I was hurt and my shoulder. I'm like, come on, dude. You can't tell me you was your shoulder. I've had basketball players who I know, who I've coached with that. And I know it's not, you don't raise your hands. You can't move your hands like that and do that. But that being aside, I just knew that Al was doing something good for boxing when, you know, when you told me that. I figured that out when I saw the two sides conflicting. When I saw the boxers happy and I saw Oscar and them do it, that was cool. You know, I didn't like Oscar's shot at you know, Floyd. You know, it's good to see him gone. And it was like, come on, man. And I know. Let's be honest. Oscar De La Hoya ran boxing for a while. He did the same thing. But now when somebody else does it, you don't like it? Like, how does that work? You know.
Well, I don't believe he ever really ran it. While he did have his own promotional company, he wasn't there mm-hmm. running that on a day-to-day basis. He only
right.
a name. And I believe that, you know, Oscar is more of a get-with-the-system kind of guy. And,
right.
you know, he had a long-time partnership with HBO. But at the end of the day, they,
right.
you know, they called the shots to a great degree.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And for whatever reason, he had such a brilliant career, and obviously he's made so much money and had so much success.
Mm-hmm.
I don't
mm-hmm.
know why he feels this jealousy or resentment towards Floyd Mayweather or anyone, because he shouldn't, you know, he's had so much, you know, success of his own that I don't understand it. But it's clear that he cannot hold it back, and it keeps coming out in his comments. And I thought in the beginning it was just part of the act, you know, when Golden
yeah,
Boy was involved
I mean,
promoting. And then I realized it's not part of the act, and I can't say I understand it, because this is a guy that shouldn't envy or whatever anyone, you know? He's done so well himself.
I honestly think he's never let go of the bitterness from their fight and from him winning, whether he liked the decision or not. I just think it comes from – I just think it's a jealousy. I just think it's just a jealousy. I don't understand why. You know, but, I mean, it's just the jealousy. And some of the things he said about Floyd, I'm just like, wow, man, you know, it's crazy. But, you know, like I said, I'm going to miss Floyd. And like I said, I'm watching the fights now, but I'm waiting for some good fights. I'm looking forward to seeing, which I think should happen, but I don't know when it's going to happen. But I think that I would love to see a Triple G fight Canelo, which I don't know if that'll happen, but I would love to see that fight. I think that'll be a rough and tumble fight. I don't think he'll beat Golovkin, but, you know, who knows? But, you know, you never
you know.
I'd
say this, that Canelo will be the best fighter Golovkin has ever faced, so we don't know if they fought. You know, he's never faced anyone as good as Canelo. Not that he doesn't
right.
look like a world beater, he does. When he fights, but what happens when we put someone else in there that's at that A-plus level? Nobody knows.
Right. And that's why I still think, you know, I knew David Lemieux wasn't going to do nothing for him. I knew that would be a slugfest. You know, and David, I knew, the only reason why I knew David Lemieux would not win that fight was because I knew David Lemieux was not a defensive fighter. He's a rock'em sock'em robot fighter. He'll get in there and he'll just keep hitting you until somebody's head comes off. And he's not going to defend himself. I believe Andre Ward can beat Triple G, only because Andre Ward is like a Floyd Mayweather. He's smart. He's gonna make adjustments. He's gonna move. He's gonna use his feet. He's not gonna stand there in front of Golovkin and I'm gonna stand here all day and bang it out with you. He's gonna get what he can get from him, and he's gonna make Golovkin miss. He's gonna make Golovkin's gonna have to find him, and he's gonna have to stalk him.
I don't believe
which then leaves
anyone that saw like Lemieux fight Rubio and get knocked out in that fight really believed he could beat Golovkin. I mean,
yeah.
You know, he is a very tough guy. He tries very hard, but he's not
mm-hmm.
in that elite class. And
no,
HBO tried to sell him to the public as something he's not. And I
right.
don't believe
and
the
I
public bought
it,
and that's why there was only about 100,000 pay-per-view buys, because, you know, people want Golovkin to be a star, but the reason that they haven't fully accepted him and the reason that they had to sell the ticket, you know, they talk about, we sold out Madison Square Garden so cheap. At what price? $20 tickets
exactly.
in 2015? And,
exactly.
you know, the pay-per-view didn't sell. People want to see him face somebody else that where nobody knows who's going to win before the fight. Another A-plus
exactly.
level fighter. Just one.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
whether it's Ward, whether
hey.
It's Canelo. And
mm-hmm.
I don't think people dislike Golovkin. You know, people say, well, there's a lot of hate. No, people hate on Mayweather, maybe Pacquiao, et cetera. People just
right.
want to see Golovkin prove it. I don't
right.
think
Does
that,
it prove
you know,
it against somebody that we know?
Nobody who,
you know
who,
right. Right. You want to see him go against somebody with some resistance. You want to see what
right.
happens when Golovkin gets hit with a good punch. What happens when, you know, when he gets, when he gets knocked down? Is he going to get back up? Can he handle it? And we want to see him come. We want to see him come through somebody that's like, okay, it's not just paper. I mean, that we want to see somebody give some give and take, some, you know, and that's what it is, you know. That and that was the main knock even on Mayweather. Well, he hasn't fought anybody. And I told him, I said, until you go, but I was telling my friends, I said, until you go back and look at all 49 fights, if you went back and looked at all 49 fights, I said, you would know that he fought somebody. The fact that he has 22 defeated world champions. I mean, more than anybody else, I'm like, and you say he didn't fight nobody? I mean, look at all the belts he put on Facebook the other day. And I'm looking at him like, this dude, like, he won. Like, this is, like, you can't, that argument is out the window, you know, but we haven't seen Golovkin face anybody like that. We've only seen Golovkin fight.
Yeah, if you
fight,
go back to Mayweather's first title fight against Genaro Hernandez,
that was
at 130
yeah, that
pounds,
was tough.
Golovkin
yep.
has never fought a guy as good as Hernandez. You know, when he
nope.
when he unified the 130-pound belt, you know, this is very
mm-hmm.
early in his career against Chico Corrales. Golovkin certainly never fought a great fighter like Corrales. So Floyd from early in his career, whether that or he was stepping up to welterweight and beating the guys like Gaddy and et cetera, you know, he's always fought guys who are at or near the Hall of Fame level, whether
and
it's Zach Judah or Shane Mosley
yep.
or Miguel
yep.
Cotto.
Yep. Yeah, and
so
I said, and the thing about it is, he fought Chico. Mm-mm. You can't. When he fought Corrales, remember, I told people, I said Corrales was knocking everybody out at that time. He was beating everybody. He was undefeated.
And
he when
was
he
a
got
great fighter.
Exactly, he
and
was a great fighter.
He was
fighter,
unbeaten,
and ordinary.
He was unbelievably big and tall for a 130 pounder.
Exactly.
And I think that
exactly.
the public was very split at the moment on who would win.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know if he would beat Corrales.
It might have been, you
know,
Floyd's most
doing.
Brilliant
mm-hmm.
or one yeah. of his most brilliant performances ever. And this is Corrales that brought us wars against Casamayor and,
yes.
You know, and against, of course, Castillo and many others. And he was just not even competitive with Floyd.
And that's what I said. I said, that's why I tell a lot of these guys who say he hasn't fought anybody. I said, see, you guys don't know anything. You know everything since, just like I try to tell you, I said, you know everything since De La Hoya or even later. I said, but you haven't gone back to all the fights in the past, you know, when he fought all these other guys, because there were no-name guys. I mean, what's the guy named from D.C.?
Chop Chop Corley?
I can't remember. Chop Chop, I told him, I said, go back and watch that Chop Chop Corley fight. And you tell me that wasn't no tough fight. I said, man, I seen Floyd got hit in that fight with some good ones. I said, he fought some guys that were no-name guys, but not no-name, like you don't talk about them now in their greatness now. But Chop-Chop,
right.
I said, man, Chop-Chop was a problem. I told him, I said, those are tough fights. I mean, I saw that.
Yep, my first
so, I mean,
live
Floyd
Mayweather
fight
was was Angel Manfredi here. And at that time,
yes,
Manfredi was a hell of a lightweight, even though Floyd dominated
exactly
him. He was a heck of a lightweight.
Was it the first
second
round?
Yeah. It was the second round.
It was like the second round. They had stopped the
yep
fight. He was beating the crap out of him. I was
and,
like, nah, good.
That was, at the time, one of the top lightweights in the world, you know?
Yep. Yeah.
I mean, that wasn't
yep
a given that Floyd would win. And and I had seen Floyd in the amateurs. I had certainly seen him on TV a lot. But seeing him live that night, I realized I was seeing something I had never seen before.
Yep. And that's what I love. That's what I loved about watching Floyd, because it was the unpredictability. It was to see the different ways he won. Because if you look at it, to me, Cotto fight was a tough fight. That was a real tough fight.
Cotto's a tough fight for anybody.
I never saw a guy hit that.
You know, he put on a heck of a show.
Exactly.
And Floyd elected to fight in the pocket. He didn't move nearly as much as he usually does. So he made it a very entertaining fight too.
Right, exactly. Well,
you hit on something. Being from Michigan, there's just such a great tradition of boxers that have come out of there, both from Detroit and Grand Rapids, that, it almost doesn't make sense. You know, when you go back to Joe Louis or Tommy Hearns and Milton McCrory and all of these guys, Hilmer Kenty, Gerald McClellan, all the great Kronk fighters. And if you look at even Grand Rapids, you've got Buster Mathis, Sr. and Jr., Tony Tucker, James Toney, originally from there and still a Michigan fighter through and through, and all of the Mayweathers. And so there's just been so many great fighters that have come out of Michigan, the amateur system there, and the slick fighters, my dearly departed friend, Emmanuel Stewart, who
Miss
his day. Maybe the greatest trainer of all time, my opinion, he was.
Absolutely.
There's something about coming from that area that just breeds, a slickness I don't think you can teach outside of those gyms where other fighters have it.
Absolutely. We got 2 minutes left in the show. It's gone very fast. But it's been very, very, very fulfilling for me and very interesting. And I just want to say, Scott, I really thank you for coming on the show. In the next 3 months, we're going to definitely get you back. I'm going to definitely call you, get you back on here. I also want to let everybody know that I'm not telling Scott this because he's here, but I'm going to just assume, is that whenever there's a big fight coming along, we're going to get him on. We're going to get Scott on to come on and talk about boxing when a big fight comes up. I would love to get you back on and have your opinion on it. But, Scott, I really want to thank you. Much success to you and Absbar. In 3 months, like I said, when you get it back up, you contact me. We'll get you back on the show. I want to thank you for interviewing with me. I want to thank you for taking the time. Much success to you. And like I said, if any of you want to look it up, please look up Scott Hurst. Research him, look at him, and please look at the apps bar and take advantage of it and look at it. And Scott, I just want to say thank you, man, for coming on. I want to thank him, and God bless you, man. And we're out of here. Thank you, Scott. I appreciate
it, man.
Thank you
so much for having me.
No, we always going any old time. Thank you so much, sir.
You
thank you. Good night, everybody. Talk to you later.